welcome to episode 10 of the Flickers from the Cave podcast. I am Marty.
I am Mike.
And we're here this week to talk about a fairly recent movie. I'm not even sure this thing's in the theaters in most of America, but it's been shown around the world. It's been shown at film festivals and stuff, and it is called I Saw the Devil.
Yes, it's a serial killer, police procedural, really interesting and beautiful in a completely brutal way. I was blown away.
It's the story, I guess, is essentially a revenge tale.
It's very straightforward.
And but it's you know, and it's got all the kind of standards of that genre, but it's also got it does some stuff that I've never seen before.
Yeah, I think this takes moral ambiguity to a new level.
Yeah, it was. We talked about this before, and the movie really reminded me a lot of the same sort of thought process that goes into play when you watch Clockwork Orange.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I would totally
agree with that.
You know, in Clockwork Orange, I guess you kind of feel bad because you start to identify and pull for Alex, but in this movie, I never really pulled for the bad guy, but there were times when I really hoped the cop wouldn't catch him again because I didn't want to see that happen again.
Yeah, it's the stuff that would happen with, and again, this is going to be a tough one. I think you and I discussed it's going to be a tough one to do without too much in the way of spoilers. We could play a shitload of clips and not worry about spoilers because it's all in Korean.
Yeah, that's going to be a struggle, too. We're going to have to come up with some sort of plan for that.
So, the basic setup is, I mean, how much should we give away of that? I think the story arc we can reveal. Because I think without revealing that, it's going to be virtually impossible to discuss the events of the movie in any kind of interesting way. We have to at least lay out the initial event and...
Well, the initial event is spelled out on the IMDb page and on the every, you know, story of the movie. It says,
okay, great.
You know, a policeman's, you know, fiance is murdered and by a serial killer, and then he vows revenge. Okay. So I think we can talk about the initial, you know, 15 minutes of the movie.
I think the thing that separates this from most revenge dramas is, when you go back and you look at something like Death Wish, which, and this is not berating Death Wish, I am actually a fan of Death Wish, and a lot, and sort of whole revenge genre, but I've never seen the material handled quite the way it's handled in this, and I'm going to get the director's name right here if I can. Please, if we have listeners in Korea or of Korean descent who can speak Korean, I apologize preemptively for my bastardization of your language. Ji-Woon Kim is the director, and the two lead actors are the police officer is played by Byung-Hun Lee, and the serial killer is Min-Sik Choi, who is amazing. I think both actors are amazing, but there is the particularly Min-Sik Choi brings a level of menace and dread and threat that's just unbelievable, and in a very understated way. There's no I don't remember his performance as being grandiose or over the top at all.
No, it's very, very well played, very straight. It reminded me a lot of Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter. I mean, there's an intelligence behind his eyes, but also an animal-like ferocity trapped in there, too, and there's a lot there's a lot that's done with very little.
Well, there's a dispassionate nature to the way what he does. It's just, it's like, where we're from, being from the South, I've been around, you know, guys that were hunters.
Right.
And when you hunt a deer, you kill a deer, you know, you're cleaning the deer, and it's just this sort of matter-of-fact thing you do. It's just part of the process. And there was, to me, that was sort of the level of just sort of, I don't know if distance is the right word, but the level of just, I hate to repeat myself. But
like the detachment.
Detachment, almost. Exactly. That's the word I was struggling to dig out of my toolbox there. But yeah, there's a complete kind of emotional detachment to what he's doing. It's just a thing he does. And it makes him for that much more menacing.
And they didn't really, you know, this, I mean, I don't think this is a spoiler to say this either, but there's no reveal of his dark desires and why he is a serial killer. It's like he just kills to kill. Like, there's no sexual or obviously sexualized part of it. He's not making a suit out of their skin. He's not doing anything like that. They didn't show him eating them. He just, you know, kills them and disposes of the body.
I think I thought there were moments where it was clear that there was a sexual element.
I think there's a sexual element before.
It's not necromantic. It's not, you know, kill these women and have sex with their dead bodies and then dispose of them. I think.
But the first kill, when he kills the wife of the cop, he kills her, he bashes her, and then takes her back to his workshop and dismembers her, and there's nothing.
But we don't know. I think.
Right, but they don't show anything, and I don't know if anything's explicitly spelled out.
No, they don't. I guess, take pains not to let us know, if there was a sexual component to that particular murder. Some of the other circumstances that come up through the movie, though, there's certainly a very obvious sexualized aspect to it, I think. I've read some stuff online, and I think we've heard some of the other films that he's made discussed on other podcasts, and there have been some kind of David Fincher comparisons, and I think that's completely legitimate. I'm not saying the guy is making films on the level of David Fincher, but he's doing some amazing stuff, and like just in terms of the technical prowess that he brings to the visuals.
Right.
The stuff just looks great. And the lighting and the way he puts a scene together, and there's just some amazing set pieces.
All right, so let's play a clip here of the initial scene where we start the film, and the wife of the detective or secret agent or whatever he is stranded in the snow with a flat tire, and she's on the phone with her fiancé, who is on a stakeout. So she's speaking to him, and suddenly a stranger drives up. So here's the clip.
사랑은 달콤하고 엄마처럼
아니 경찰을 부르는데 왜 그 바퀴를 왜 갖게 되냐 아니 여기 사람들이 많네 왔다 갔다
차가 완전히 다 주저앉았네요.
아, 감사한데요. 그냥 경인차 기다리는 게 좋을 것 같아요. 고맙습니다.
in that clip, you could hear the conversation, and I mean, basically what was happening there is the guy who comes up to the window of the car is the killer, and he is a bad person, but he offers to take a look at her tire. It says he could, you know, maybe help her out, and tells her that, you know, with the snow that's falling, that the tow truck is going to be it's going to be a long time before it gets there, but he'd be happy to help. And she says, you know, no, thank you. I think I'll just wait for the tow truck. And her fiance is telling her the same thing. Hey, don't let him in the car. Just wait for the tow truck. And then it's not long after that that the killer returns and gets into the car. So, but that's the initial setup, and you can hear the glass breaking there at the end as he smashes his way into the car and then continues to smash her. And it is not fun at all to watch.
No, it is not. And I'm not 100% positive, but I think that I saw the devil may actually translate directly into Korean as blunt head trauma, because there's a lot of blunt head trauma in this film.
There's a lot of blunt trauma on various parts of the human body.
I don't know how much to say. I want to address the fact that he figures out who the killer is, and he's torturing the guy.
Yes. Well,
is that too much of a spoiler?
No, I think you're safe there. We know about the setup. We know that it's a revenge movie, so you can only, I think, assume that the revenge is going to come from the cop on the killer.
Okay.
And normally, in a movie like this, that would mean he would go get the killer and he would kill them.
Right.
But after his spouse or his fiance's death, the policeman vows to give the killer 10,000 times the amount of suffering that the killer gave his fiance.
The fact that the person who is seeking his rewenge is a police officer or an agent, or it's he has access to resources that the average revenge driven, you know, person driven mad by their desire for revenge wouldn't have access to.
Right, I think he's like an FBI or CIA type agent.
Yeah, high level kind of guy, because he has access to a lot. He goes in and he can get files of the likely suspects who may be the ones who were at least accused of similar type crimes previously. And
right.
And he uses that as a method to sort of track down to the one that he knows is the killer. And some really clever use of some electronic technology to track the movements and to be aware of the goings on pertaining, like, just to keep up with what this guy's doing, what this guy's
right.
up to. I thought that was remarkably clever, a clever idea.
Yeah, the normal sort of, when you hear the term, it's a cat and mouse game, you know, you think that it's the killer, or the bad person playing a game, you know, and then the cops have to catch him, you know, and he's giving them little clues and all this stuff. But in this case, it's almost like a inverted cat and mouse game, because the cop keeps giving the killer a little bit of rope,
yeah.
A little bit of rope, and lets him go out and almost do a bad thing, and then he swoops in and destroys him, and then gives him some more rope and lets him go out and do it again, and just keeps doing it and doing it and doing it. And it is amazing.
It is amazing. It's amazingly brutal. I mean, some of the fight scenes, they're not stylized martial arts movie fight scenes. They are just brutal, hard, vicious fight scenes that, I mean, you can feel I think you and I discussed when we initially discussed the movie, and you were describing your take on it, and when you were describing sort of the fight scenes, and I asked, was it martial arts? And you said, well, sorta. And we said it was like Sonny Chiba martial arts.
Yeah.
Where it's like, there's no, you know, fanciful backflips or anything.
No wire work.
No wire work. Nobody's like flying through a forest of bamboo. This is like, pick up a rock and bludgeon somebody to unconsciousness.
It's a very physical, very gritty, very brutal fight. Every fight in it. I mean, there's some amazing sort of parkour stuff where the dude's leaping up walls and things. That's all amazing. But when it gets down to the, you know, down to bare knuckles, that shit is on.
It was one of the most tense and suspenseful things I'd seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Because you really did not know where things were. I mean, there were, I would catch myself right in the middle of a scene and not know what the hell was going on. And not in the kind of Michael Bay bad editing, wait, who was that? Wait, that car was over there kind of way. It was just...
Right. Weren't they going the other direction a minute ago?
Right.
Hold on.
It was the motivation of the characters. It is such a complex character study. I mean, you see, again, like you said, you never reach that level of empathy for the killer the way you do, to some extent, with Alex in A Clockwork Orange, but you do begin to kind of question, like, what this guy is doing, the police inspector. It's like, just how long are you going to go on with this?
Right.
And how brutal are you going to be with this guy?
And would your fiance want you to do this?
Right.
You know, are you honoring her memory with this sort of behavior?
Are you honoring her memory, or are you letting the actions of a monster turn you into a monster?
Right, exactly. It's very interesting the way that they display this stuff and sort of unravel it.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. It really is an amazing movie, and it's a fairly long. I mean, for sort of a genre piece, and I think that you have to consider it a genre piece. I mean, it is a revenge thriller at its heart, but the at no point during the 2 hours and 20 minutes maybe.
It's long, yeah.
At no point during that running time did I catch myself going, okay, come on, let's, you know, pick up the pace. It's paced perfectly, and there are some scenes of and I don't want to give away any specifics, because there are spoilers that I want anybody that listens to this and goes out and seeks this movie out and watches it, and I'm, you know, based on our recommendation, I don't want to ruin anything, but there are some scenes where you are so tense and in such a knot, and then there is just this explosion of violence.
Right.
But it's like not cathartic, or like it's not where like that happens in some movies and it's like the release of a pressure valve.
Right.
It's not like that at all.
No, it's just uncomfortable and squirmy, and
you go from being completely tense and like in a knot to like going, "Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god," and it's just, oof.
Yeah, the killer is just unflappable. You know, through all of this, he mostly stays cool and kind of manages to find his way, you know, from one thing to the next, and it's astounding.
Well, I think that adds to the level of fear, or to the level of anxiety about this character, and I think your reference earlier to Hannibal Lecter, that's completely apropos, because that efficiency and expertise at what he's doing, and the fact that he is utterly unfazed and completely fearless in the face of the police or the possibility of being caught or anything it just shows that this is something that, without going into any sort of elaborate backstory, it just shows that this is something that he's been doing and doing and doing, and you know, there's no, you just, without any exposition, you know, this guy's been at this for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
There were, you know, there were one or two things I think that you and I talked about that were sort of like, that was pretty movie, but it was sort of a way to kind of keep the plot moving forward. It's brilliant storytelling. I mean, they managed to invest so much into these characters without any really expository dialogue. I mean, you know what I mean? Or that's my impression anyway.
It was very lean, the way the story was told. I mean, you knew good guy, bad guy, and then they revealed bits about the relationships and stuff. One of the more interesting relationships was the, cops, the father-in-law-to-be, you know, yes. the father of the girl who's murdered at the beginning of the movie, who was the former chief of this agency.
Yeah.
So, and he's, I think, retired, but he's still an important figure in that group, and so the people, you know, respect him very much, and, you know, and I think there's all this stuff where the father's feeling very depressed, not only about his daughter dying, but the fact that, you know, that he's the former chief of police and he couldn't do anything about it, and, you know, and all these people taking this guilt and blame onto themselves for this, the act of this horrible person, and all that stuff's very complicated and very interesting, and that guy's amazingly, like, sweet and I keep saying interesting, yeah, but very sympathetic, but also really, like, this, you could see this, you know, this guy had, like, this storied past, and that he's this, you know, figure to these people, and, you know, that they're all feeling his pain, and it's, I don't know, it's really cool. Like, you get an idea of a very close-knit subculture there.
Well, you also can tell, you know, that he is aware of what the agent is up to.
Well, sure, because he's the one who hooks him up with those initial leads.
Yeah, he's helped him, and I think that there's some degree of reticence on his part of, have I done the right thing here? Again,
yes.
I mean, this is like moral ambiguity to the 10th power. There's so much more going on here. This would have been, I mean, and not to be slamming American movies, but, you know, you might have been able to make this movie in the States in the 70s, but a movie like this would never be made here now. Not within the context of the studio system. You might could make something kind of like an indie thing, but, like, it's just too complicated. There's just no clear cut. I mean, even though it's obvious, yeah, this guy, it's a good guy, this is a bad guy, it so quickly devolves into this situation where people's motivations, I mean, there's no, you never at any point think that the bad guy, the quote-unquote bad guy, the villain, no part of him is good. I mean, there's
right.
nothing good about him. But it is so, like, the stuff that you wind up getting into with the police officer is so bad and rough. I mean, Harry Callahan would have been going, hey, you would take it down a notch there, Chief.
Yeah, he takes Loose Cannon to a whole new level.
That's right. I don't need your gun and your shield. I need your arms and legs on my desk by morning.
And your soul.
That's right. I need your gun and your soul by morning.
The bad guy is never, he's no anti-hero. This is not a guy that you kind of, you know, cheer on as he does bad things. You know, he's not the Joker in Batman where there's moments where he's entertaining. This guy is always bad and always, like, super ultra bad. He's a extremely dark individual. But the cop, who is ostensibly the good guy, as he gets closer and closer to this killer, you know, he gets closer and closer to this killer and his mannerisms and his activities, too. I mean, he's not going out and hunting down the innocent. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe he is a little bit, but But he's mainly hunting down this killer and trying to make him suffer. And there are moments where I think the whole idea of what should be allowed and what's good and, you know, safe for police to do starts to be, you know, right in the forefront of your mind. I really would have never, I mean, I don't know, it's a movie, so it's not one of those things where you're really going to, I guess, put this into a real life situation, but, wow.
But I think these circumstances do arise, and I think that there are moments where things like this, I mean, obviously this is hyper stylized, and it goes beyond maybe a level of what you might encounter in reality, but I think that, I mean, when you listen to people talk, if you talk to somebody about things that are happening that we see in the news,
yeah,
which I think both of us are very consciously outside that news cycle, so we may not be having these conversations, but when I hear people talk about, oh, did you hear about that case with the little girl or whatever, they should just do the same thing to that guy.
Right.
Like, did you hear what this guy did to his wife? Well, that's what they should do to him, or vice versa. I don't want to be perceived as sexist in one way or the other. But I think there is an innate human characteristic that almost leads people to want to say, you know, that maybe it's something that's ingrained into us from a Judeo-Christian background of the eye for an eye concept.
Right.
That, like, if, you know, if you do something horrible to a person, you deserve to have the same level of pain and horror inflicted upon you.
Right.
And I think that this film is a really interesting exploration of that. It mm-hmm. takes that concept and sort of plays it out in a very non-judgmental way.
Well, I mean, it's if it were truly going to be an eye for an eye, though, it would be, okay, let's take him and do what he did to whoever. But, I mean, he's just one man. I mean, if you killed him the way he killed a person, then, you know, you can't get revenge on him for all those others.
But I think that it becomes, and this is interpretive on my part, or at least I don't want to say intuitive, because that seems like I'm blowing my own horn, but I think, I'll say interpretive, because this is sort of what I took away from the idea. Clearly, the guy, the police inspector, is doing exactly what he states that he is going to do. He's going to get his revenge on this guy, and he's going to make it 1,000 or 10,000 times worse than what his fiance suffered. But
right.
I think as the story progresses along and it becomes clear that there's a pattern of behavior and that this guy... And I think that's part of the idea of the use of the technology, is let's just see what this guy's all about. And when he goes in and has his initial encounter and does what he does, and then it becomes clear to him that this is a pattern of behavior,
right.
that this guy is going to continue to follow this pattern of behavior,
mm-hmm.
that's why it becomes an eye for an eye. Every time this guy is about to do, I think the police inspector has satisfied his own belief or his own satisfaction that this guy, his wife or his fiance, was not the first victim.
Oh yeah, the reason that he's on that list of suspects is because I mean, he's been on that list for a while. Like, here's a guy they're watching because they think he might be involved in some nefarious deeds.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't like they said, hey, here's this guy who we think killed that girl. It was like, hey, here's one of these people we think's doing a whole lot of bad things.
Exactly. And so that gives the guy the impetus to suspect that the guy deserves a more fitting punishment for his behavior. And after the use of the technology, and again, I'm sort of skirting that because I think that's a really clever little sort of plot device to progress the story along. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's the key central part of how he's able to do what he does.
So, and I think that when he sees that the results of doing that, and he sees where that is leading him, and he sees that, yes, I'm right, this guy's a bad guy, and he wasn't a bad guy one time. He is a bad guy
all the time.
To the core.
Yes.
And I think that's where you get into the eye for an eye and the level of brutality that is inflicted upon him in the police inspector's mind is completely justified.
Yeah.
And it's up to the viewer to say, and again, that's part of the beauty of this thing. That's part of the beauty of the sort of the ambiguous nature of what the director's putting out here is like, how much is too much? Who, you know, that question of who's the monster now, just like Clockwork Orange, where this is just sort of a microcosmic version of that, where in Clockwork Orange, you've got the disenfranchised youth, Alex is the representative of that larger whole, and
right.
Then you've got the system, and the system is to me what is represented by the one police inspector here.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this. Yeah. I mean, I agree with all that. Yeah.
I'm trying to pin down. There's what made it seem so relevant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I hear people make these statements, these blanket statements of like, you know, if somebody is convicted of murder, they should just be killed.
Yes.
And, you know, the very pro-death penalty people, and then, you know, maybe in some dark recess of my psyche that I think that that's right.
Yeah.
But I also, you know, you hear stories about these guys that are vindicated after being in jail on death row for 20 years because now there's DNA technology that proves that they didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly. I mean, that's just happened recently.
Yeah, absolutely. I just heard this story on NPR, and the guy whose brother had been murdered showed up at the release party for the guy that had been in prison for 20 years, and he came into the room, and he was the one that broke down and started crying, and the guy that had just gotten out of prison came over and consoled and hugged and showed love to this guy that helped get him convicted. And
well, I mean, it's humans are amazing creatures.
I just think that this movie does a good job of kind of exploring the intricacies of the human psyche in a way that a lot of movies don't. I mean, much as I think more than and this is not saying I think it's a better movie than Silence of the Lambs, but Silence of the Lambs was a lot easier to kind of figure out where you were.
Well, it's a bad guy and a good guy.
Yeah, it's good. It's clear. It's more. It's like,
you know, Lecter, I guess, is gray because he's, you know, so charismatic.
Yeah, he's charismatic, but you also and he will lull you. He will dazzle you with his intellect and his charm.
Right.
And
but you in that movie, you had Buffalo Bill just going out and skinning people, and you had Jodie Foster just trying to catch him. So you had a good guy, bad guy, and like the Lecter character was just a bit player. I mean, it wasn't the Hannibal Lecter show.
Right, it was a peripheral character.
Yeah, it was a great character, and that's why they, you know, he's been in so many books by Thomas Harris and, you know, had his own movie and his own, you know, he's just a fascinating character. You also have Anthony Hopkins. But, yeah, it's a very different, I saw The Devil's very different in the way it handles all that stuff because it is just, here is this unbelievably loathsome human being who does unbelievably loathsome stuff. To me, the problem, the biggest issue with the cop, as far as is he doing what he should be doing, is that for him to let give the killer some line and to let him run and go off and do his thing before he, you know, swoops in and stops him, every time he gave him some line, he was putting people's lives at risk.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was putting innocent people's lives on the line.
There's no guarantee he could get there and stop.
No.
What was could potentially happen.
And that was why it was wrong and bad to me that he was doing that. I mean, that it wasn't that the killer didn't deserve to be tortured, so it was that we didn't need innocent people's lives put in the balance for revenge. You know, adding another innocent person's life to the death toll wasn't going to help at all in his quest for revenge.
Yeah.
So to me, that was the big struggle, and I don't know, and I've never wanted the cop to do that. I mean, when the cop was kicking ass and smashing people, I was like, yeah, do it. But when he was, you know, like I said, giving that guy a little line and letting him run, I was just like, stop it. Go stop him. Get him. Take him out.
Well, when you refer to it as not the typical cat and mouse game, it upends the whole idea, because typically if you think of cat and mouse game in context of a film, the bad guy's the cat and the victims are the mouse. And in this, what the police officer does is like what you see a cat do with a mouse. You see him hurt the creature and then let it go and then chase it a little more.
Right, just toy with it.
Prolong the agony. And
but I guess when a cat's playing with a mouse, the mouse is terrified, and I don't think that killer was at any point terrified in this movie. He was just pissed.
He was pissed, but I think that the actor...
Let's just call him the killer, we don't have to struggle with that pronunciation.
Okay, the killer in the film.
Not Jerry Lee Lewis.
There were... the killer. There were clearly scenes where he was... confused. He was stymied by the motivation of the police officers. Like, why don't you just kill me?
Yes.
Just do this thing. Because I think that in his mind that would have been a more satisfactory outcome. And I think there's even a scene where he asked him that.
Yes.
Just
there
do
is.
It. It's man, I tell you, it's unlike anything I've seen.
Yes, and in a very good way, it's unlike anything I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it completely, I know you said that you had seen JSA, and I may have seen it. I don't remember it if I did.
I swear, I think we watched it.
But I really am anxious now to see. I want to go back and see. And we watched Three Extremes, and I have a hazy recollection of that, unfortunately, as well. I would like to go back and see some of the other stuff this guy's done, because this was completely impressive to me from every standpoint. From technically, it was amazing. And like some of the action set pieces.
Yeah, I mean, this just everything in it was great. Now the Three Extremes I think we saw was not the one that this guy did a part of.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think there was two Three Extremes.
That's not confusing at all.
That's like six extremes.
23 extremes.
Yeah, because I think the first Three Extremes was the one that had Takashimike and. Had the one about the dumplings.
Okay, that was not his Masters of Horror.
No, that was a different thing.
That actually, as a completely non sequitur, I found out that is on streaming Netflix.
That the Takashimike?
Yes, which shocked the hell out of me.
You going to watch it again?
No.
Yeah, I'm not really interested in watching it again either.
I got no truck with that. I have no desire to see that again. And I mean, it's not because it was not well made; it's because it was just too damn well made.
Yeah, apparently his new film, which is like a samurai film,
yes,
is like maybe his masterpiece. Which I've heard that about six or seven times in reference to Miike. So
well, and he tends to do that. He tops himself.
Yes.
The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, I have heard of. I have not seen. This is other films by
Ji-Woon Kim.
Yes, you're correct. Three Extremes 2 was what he did a part of.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, I've not seen other stuff this guy did. I mean, and he's got nine titles on his filmography. One was a segment in an anthology. One was a short. So the guy is a relatively... I don't want to say inexperienced, but relatively new filmmaker. He's been making movies for, looks like, 13 years.
Yeah.
Which is a, you know, I mean, that's no way to judge. But this is so sure-handed and remarkably well done. It makes me really want to see other stuff that he did.
I mean, you can look at somebody like Terrence Malick, who, you know, has only made a few movies, you know, but... Yeah, they're good.
Yeah, it will. Really, yeah, exactly. I mean, he's made like what, 6 or 8 over his entire career, long career, and they're all basically he rolls from masterpiece to masterpiece. And I wouldn't say that everything Quentin Tarantino's done has been a masterpiece, but he's made a lot of damn good movies, and he hasn't made that many movies.
Right, right. And it's why it's a big deal when you get a new one announced.
So, yeah. So,
I just love the fact that now we're able to look beyond our borders for these directors like Ji-Woon Kim, and we can kind of get excited about his next movie.
Yes. Yeah, I'm ready to just pretty much ready to watch about anything this guy does.
Well, I'll bring in the good, the bad, and the weird, and
maybe
let
we
you
can have that on an upcoming episode.
Yeah, because I've heard nothing but great stuff about it.
Well, as
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was about to sort of move into different territories. So.
I was too.
Okay, well, go, and then I'll follow.
All right. Well, I think we should also thank the friend of the show, Daria, because it was Daria who hooked us up with I Saw the Devil and rave reviewed it and made us interested and curious. So thank you, Daria. That was awesome, and we owe you for that one.
And thank you for just being interested and being a listener. And, you know, we apologize for the infrequency of the podcast. We're trying to get them out there more often. Life often conspires to make it difficult to do so, but no part of the infrequency is because of our lack of desire to do this, because we always enjoy it and are excited when we have a new one to release. But yes, thanks, Daria, for this and other recommendations that you've made, and the site that you turned us on to was great.
But I'm gonna not thank you for the Human Centipede, but you know, just
I haven't watched that yet. So, but now just for the line, feed her.
Yeah,
I feel compelled to watch it.
Yeah, I mean it's just bad, you know.
I do.
But the Mad Scientist is so fabulously over the top. If they made a remake of that, they would have to get Udo Kier. To play the Mad Scientist if they make a remake, because the guy was totally exuding that Udo Kier charm.
Well, I do. I think we can. We should throw in as a closing note, and this has nothing to do with I Saw the Devil or anything about any highbrow cinema at all, but having just watched Piranha 3D, not in 3D, but just as an honorable mention almost, I would like to throw that in, that is a highly satisfying piece of mindless gore, exploitation cinema that was in the greatest tradition of Roger Corman and Joe Dante and all the guys that it's indebted to.
What the hell this thing is doing in my lake?
Where did you get this?
Oh, in the middle of the lake, where there are 2 people dead. Oh my, yeah, that's right. Oh my. Excuse me, but is that a fucking piranha?
Carl, it's not the only one.
Yeah, here, look at this. There are thousands of them. Thousands. And they're pissed.
You know, I've heard of this happening. It's like those baby alligators in New Jersey. Someone leaves them, and then they breed.
What?
No. Release this fish into the lake.
What are you talking about?
This particular piranha vanished off the face of the earth more than 2 million years ago.
It was so much more than it had any right to be. All the little nods and winks to films past, like the opening bit with Richard Dreyfuss. And just so many little Easter eggs here and there that it was throwing, and just all of them were perfect, and it was funny, and everybody was obviously having a great time. The monster fish were fantastic, and it was genuinely scary in times. And
yeah, really tense and exciting, and some of the most over the top gore I've seen for a while.
Yes.
And
yeah, well, Jerry O'Connell on the deck of the boat. That was just gross.
That was nasty. Just the aftermath of the where they really invade the shoreline there. Like,
yes,
a lot of the people being dragged out of the water, half gone, and well,
they do such a good job of, like, you know, you think about Jaws, you know, all time classic, top 10 for sure, but it's like, you know, just a handful of people are actually victims of the shark,
right?
And in this thing, there's like 100 people in like one scene, all being eaten by these piranhas.
Yes,
and it's just so over the top. And and they make it scary, but they don't ever make it like hard to watch. Like, it's like you're going, oh my god, oh geez, oh no. But there's, you know, like all the people that are dying are not the main characters, you know, for the most part. And so there's like a lot, you get a lot of action, a lot of destruction and stuff, but then you've got like, you know, this small band of people that you're pulling for.
Right. And I would just want to say, I'm ready for any action movie cast with Elizabeth Shue as the heroine.
Yeah, she's great.
Because she was great in it, and she totally made me believe that she was a badass and could hold her own. And I was really impressed with her.
Yeah, she was just amazing. Everybody was great, and I thought Ving Rhames was good, and
Ving Rhames is just like the man. I mean, I can't think of a thing I've seen him in I didn't like him. I might have seen movies that he was in that I didn't like the movie, but he is just one of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, I hope he has a long and storied career as a character actor, because he totally deserves it.
What was the one about the Chuck and Larry or whatever, where Adam Sandler and
I pronounce
the other guy,
Chuck and Larry or something.
Yeah, like where that. He was in it and he was gay, right?
Saw that.
Oh, really? Yeah, you get to see Ving Rhames play a gay fireman, and it's awesome.
Me too.
You too? You too what?
I'm gay. I can't believe I finally said it. Oh, God, it feels so good. It feels like a wave is crashing over me. Ooh. Ow! It's so liberating.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you said it?
First time I said it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I was with Larry.
Your lover.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, is absolutely gorgeous.
Thanks. He's mine, though, so...
No, that's your man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My whole life, I've been living a lie. But you and Larry have given me the strength to be true to myself. To thine own self be true. There's nothing worse than pretending to be something that you're not.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm glad. I'm glad we helped you out, and, anything else we can do, you don't hesitate to ask.
Would you help me tell my parents?
I guess.
Yes!
Oh, whoa.
Oh, yes, 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 girl!
Guys, thanks again for coming back and downloading another episode. Thanks again to Daria, and thanks to Jiwon Kim for kicking my ass cinematically, and, I'm looking forward to what he does next and going back and reinvestigating the stuff he's done up till now. And so we look forward to talking to you on episode 11 of
Hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon. So look for episode 11 of Flickers from the Cave. And I'm Mike.
I'm Marty.
Thanks for hanging out with us for an hour.
They took my penis.
Ah!